Good morning. This is Teacher Talk from killradio.org with your host, Nick Richert, who is interviewing Mark Hempel on the phone as we begin.
Okay, so we're talking to Mark Hempel. And, Mark, can you repeat your question?
Sure. Really wasn't a question. It's just that, you know, I was mentioning from last week, you did have a speaker on who reported her experiences with evaluation and her alternative approach to it, which made a lot of sense, and it was very logical in its progression. And I do remember recommending putting that into, or summarizing it into a short article for Perdaily and submitting it there where we could possibly get it published, but I haven't heard anything back from that, so I don't know if she's actually proceeded in that direction.
That was Lisa Alva, and I will email her and ask her.
Yeah, we are waiting for that because we're looking for an alternative model, and certainly an alternative approach to evaluation would fit the bill for that.
Okay.
Otherwise, you know, we mentioned the Mark and Neil debates, which have gone on. I guess you did part two of that last Thursday.
Yeah, the libertarian versus the communist.
Yeah, and what does that amount to? See, a libertarian now, they're for personal rights, am I correct? Not particularly
yeah.
Freedom of speech. And then a council communist opposes state capitalism in favor of workers, am I correct on that?
Pretty much.
Yeah, I don't want to do a political science lesson on it because I'm not qualified to do that. But, I mean, what that really came down to is, if you want to get this the gist of this, I suggest waiting for it to be archived and listening there, because I mean, it's the same theme, decentralized small markets versus plant production for use and not for profits. So, you know, if you want to follow this, catch the next installment on, what, the 1st of September, and check the archives for what's already gone on.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, next Thursday they're going to do it again.
Yeah, I don't know how many times they're going to do it, but neither one of them seems to be wearing out.
I know. I'm inviting them back just as long as they got energy for this.
Oh, well, I can tell you right now, sensing what the personalities are, they could probably take you into December on this.
Or I thought you were going to say the next decade.
I didn't want to be that predictive on it, you know, because there's a point where next sooner or later you're going to say, okay, we know enough about this.
Right.
Yeah. So you have to have some other form of debate there.
So let's get into the news, Mark.
Okay. More importantly, we had the leadership conference at La Quinta last weekend. The keynote speaker there was Maxine Waters, and that in itself was pretty controversial when you figure she's involved in an influence peddling scandal herself right now.
So you're talking about the union's annual leadership conference that they have at La Quinta. I don't know if it's there every year.
Yeah, well, I don't believe it's at that location necessarily every year, but this is the annual meeting they have just prior to the beginning of the new school year in which they more or less chart the direction that the union is going in.
Is there some kind of a report back from this meeting where we find out what they came up with?
I've found several reports, but they're not informal reports. They're actually formal reports from people who are there, but strangely enough, although this is a week old now, there has been no media coverage of it that's noticeable, or else we would have seen it by now. And I'm assuming that we're waiting for the next issue of the UT to get any definitive information on that.
Okay. Anything else about that you wanted to say, or should we wait till it comes out?
Well, a couple of interesting things. Waters, again, this is strange coming from someone who is being accused of funneling business toward her husband. She stated that she doesn't dislike the past leadership of A.J. Duffy, but that she doesn't dislike him, but she dislikes his, let me correct myself, she dislikes his leadership. But regardless of that, whatever her opinion was, when it came time for the recognition plaque, Duffy received his. So I guess that was more or less just a side comment, which didn't bear a lot of other, let's say, expression.
Okay.
Sort of a surprise guest, although I don't know how you would consider him a surprise guest, but he was announced as such, was Warren Fletcher. And his major plan was to hire a professional negotiator to negotiate with the district for the union membership. That's been suggested before. There are various opinions on it, like, shouldn't we be more qualified than a professional negotiator? But is this the only way to go because our own negotiators don't seem to understand the process well enough to deal with LA Unified? Take your pick on that. I don't know.
Okay. So Waters, Fletcher.
Yeah, and And Louise Weiner was their major guest speaker, well-known writer on education. And the view that was expressed there was that schools aren't corporations, and consequently they don't know how to handle it. You know, that's an interesting statement, but on the other hand, if in reality, LAUSD is a corporation. Look at the way it's handled. I mean, they're trying to separate something from being a corporation, which is a corporation. So I don't understand. I mean, I understand what that was all about, but I don't understand quite why Weiner would feel that way, that you're asking a corporation or a corporate-level actor to behave outside of their own characteristic behavior.
How is she asking them to behave outside of their characteristic behavior?
Stop. I think what he means is this. Stop looking at kids as commodities,
right,
and see them as sentient, living beings. That's my impression.
And do it fairly and respecting cultural differences and do it for all of our how many students?
I think that's a good summary based on what I read as a summary of his statements. But of course, I didn't see the entire address. But I think what you're saying would be at least relatively accurate.
All right.
And there was also a push for enforcement of AB 114. If you're not familiar with that, it does two things that we would like. You know, if there are any new funds come in, they should be spent to retain teachers. And this is the big one that the district seems to be completely refusing to obey, and that is that they have to maintain the staff levels from last year.
That's AB 114.
That's AB 114. So I think you're going to see a lot of action on that. LA Unified and a couple of other big districts are refusing to adhere to it. So I don't know what their rationale is for refusing to adhere to it. I guess we're going to find out over time.
Okay. Well, anything else you got today, Mark?
Yeah, moving on. David Garcia, as you remember, he ran for UTLA president. He submitted a letter to the union, an open letter, which was titled, "We Deserve a Courteous Answer." And what it was saying that any further collusion with the district is the equivalent of representational treason, and that union leadership is subject to accountability, so we need to know what they're doing, and they need to stop doing it. Curiously enough, none of the high-ranking officers answered to it. However, Scott Mandel did, who holds a number of positions in the various committees. He's a well-known name within the union. And his take on it was that any criticism of the union is disunity. And if you had any criticism of the union, it should be done privately. There was a reply from Francisco Martinez, who came within a very short distance of winning one of the VP positions in the last election, who pointed out that union officers were public figures, and consequently they're subject to scrutiny. We could go on and on about this.
Interesting. I would love to see a debate between Scott Mandel and Francisco Martinez on
that. That would be very good. If we could arrange that, you would have a lot of listeners. What it comes down to, though, is this, is that Mandel publicly held that both Garcia and Martinez are dividers. In other words, they're just cut-down specialists. They're haters. And, in fact, for some reason, he referred to Neil Chartkoff as a tyrant. But I'm not sure what that's all about. But anyway, it would be interesting to put that together, because we're just talking about statements that were made. I don't have a real extension on what Mandel meant by his response, and I only have what Francisco Martinez and David Garcia said flatly. I'm sure there's a lot more to this than what I'm reporting.
Well, you know, this is an interesting little slice of union strife going on. It's a whole world that most people don't have any access to.
Well, here's the thing, Nick. When this leadership conference is held, it is unexpressedly for the purpose of the current union to consolidate its power. In other words, to separate itself from last year's leadership, or the last term leadership, that would include A.J. Duffy, and move on its own.
Okay. Well,
right.
Moving on to your next... Yeah.
Okay. What we want to look at now is the status of displaced teachers and RIF. Apparently there are 450 displaced teachers. They'll be heading back to the teacher pools, which means they're paid daily. They may or may not work, but they're on call. They're ready to move when they're called in. I've heard various expressions from them. Some of them all of them are uncomfortable with that because, of course, it's not stable. And some of them feel that they're sort of handled as lesser entities on the rung of status with the teachers who aren't in the pool system, but at least they're employed and they know they're getting they're covered by their benefits. As for the 1,300 to 1,500 RIFs, according to which reporter you hear, I think it's basically around 1,450. If you were a RIF recently, that's in 2011, you have the option of going into SubFinder where you'll be ahead of the regular subs. In other words, in seniority, you'll surpass all the regular subs no matter how long they've been in there. If you're a RIF teacher from the 2009 group, which was the original RIF, you go into SubFinder, but because you were a probationary teacher, your seniority is determined by your hire date. So you're competing according to when you came in to the district on the same level as the regular subs.
Okay, so what's the up? Is there an upshot to all this?
The only thing I can say is those people who were displaced, again, they at least have a position. Those who weren't displaced that were RIFed in 2011, they're priority subs, so they have greater likelihood of receiving that call because they get preference to go to various schools on a day-to-day basis. And those who are in 2009, you're just competing with the other subs who have now had their possibility of working on a given day diluted by the fact that there's an entry of all the 2009 RIFs into the sub pool now.
All right. So
That's where you stand on that.
And then there's something about, while all these teachers with experience in the district are going on to be subs, you have a whole lot of new teachers being brought in from Teach for America. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I didn't mention that, but now that you brought that up, Teach for America is a program which, quite literally, they're bringing in teachers fresh out of college, and this includes those with their diploma from online academies to those who came through any college you want to name. And what it is an agreement that they'll go into the inner city schools and be assigned a position. It's against a negotiated loan, which is given to them for them, I guess, to complete their credential work or whatever else that needs to be done. They're paid practically nothing. Whatever money they receive would amount to about a third of what a teacher's currently making. And I don't mean one of the teachers that have been in for years and years. I'm talking about beginning teacher level. So they're practically getting paid nothing. And the idea is that they'll complete their credential, pay back their loan, and be invested into the system. But in the meantime, of course, every one of those that is hired represents another probationary teacher who won't be brought back, or another teacher who was risked in one way or another who may not be able to resume a position. So the clarity on this and the way that works is not at all something that we can appraise yet, because there's not enough out on how this is going to work. I mean, does this constitute that people who are risked will, or a good share of them, won't be coming back to their positions?
You mean, and this has to do with Teach for America candidates, because, they'll no longer need these RIF people.
Yeah, absolutely right. Well, why would I hire someone that I have to bring in at, 37, 38, 39,000 if I can bring someone in for, I think it comes out to around 13,000.
All right. Well, thanks, Mark. Do you have anything else for us today?
Quickly, A.J. Duffy, following up on what we said last week, he is a CEO for the Crescendo Charter School Group. They were decertified a little while ago in a scandal on test score cheating. Some of those teachers who participated in the test score cheating became whistleblowers. They got in contact with Duffy. Consequently, he wound up being the CEO. His plan is to recertify Crescendo under the Apple Academy, which would be a union charter. Lots of opinions on this right now as to, divided loyalties or true loyalties. I mean, I'm seeing people actually who participate in the union suggesting that he's deserted the union membership, the students, the teachers that he formerly served by doing so. But I guess the defense of this, which I've also heard, is that the man's looking for a job. This was the job that was presented. If this was the job that was offered you, would you take it or not?
All right. So, well, Duffy, CEO of what's the charter school group?
Right now, it's the Crescendo Charter School Group. If Duffy gets his way, it'll be converted to the Apple Academy.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mark, and I'm trying to get out of here.
Okay, one more quick thing. A report came in from, or two more real quick. National Council on Teacher Quality put out a bulletin, which was well published, saying that principals need to be more empowered, more control over teacher salaries, more control over hiring, more control over evaluations, you know, market-driven approach. And finally, a request from Lenny Eisenberg of Perdaily.com, my colleague, I guess you can refer to him as that.
Yeah.
If any of you have firsthand knowledge of test score cheating within the district, please report it to Perdaily.com or directly to Lenny at Perdaily.com. You can do this anonymously. It is not necessary that you reveal yourself, and we're not looking for secondhand or third-hand stories. We're talking about something that you actually know of because you witnessed it. You know that this took place. We would like to assemble as much of this as possible to present it to the district and ask them what their excuse is for it, that they're permitting this to go on within their schools.
Cool. Thanks, Mark.
All right, Nick, that's it. That's the news.
All right. Sounds good. Have a great day.
Have a good day, man.
You too. Bye.
So long now.
All right. That was Mark from, he does a lot of things, but one thing is perdaily.com, and he does that with Lenny Eisenberg, and they're asking for evidence of cheating. Any teachers know about cheating on tests going on? They let teachers grade their own tests. Get in touch with perdaily.com. And so now I'm going to continue an interview that was in progress with Ellen Kirschbaum from New York. She's the superintendent of alternative schools in Queens, or she was, and she does this great program in schools using theater. She brings in artists who come in and show kids how to put on plays. But she has a lot of thoughts all over the spectrum. And this conversation is in progress with Ellen Kirschbaum from New York City. Okay, so this is Ellen Kirschbaum. Ellen, you, among other things, have started two schools, and you were just telling me about them.
I started in the school system with a special education class and found out very, very soon that my college guitar and singing with those students and creating performances with those students was the thing that really changed the classroom paradigm, and they began to feel a lot better about themselves and do good work. Later on in my career, I had a chance to take a group of students from fifth grade to sixth grade working with another person using the performing arts again. And then my principal suggested that I create my own small school, and I did. And that was a school in East Harlem, which was a junior high school, and we used the performing arts as a vehicle for excellence. Most of the students in East Harlem at that time were not going on to good high schools. Their lives were fairly limited academically, and it was a time in East Harlem when really incredibly exciting things were going on. All kinds of new schools were being created in East Harlem in the early 70s. Debbie Meyer, the famed reformer, and I were the first two people in District 4 to create small schools, and mine was a performing arts school, and hers was famous CPE model. And that was incredibly successful. And because of Facebook now, I actually hear from those students who are almost 50 years old, and I get love letters from them telling them that that time in that school informed their, not only their academic life, but their lives and how they raise their children and how they are now grandparents. And Facebook has really been an incredible thing, because most times teachers and educators don't really know what happens once that's over. You just put it out there into the atmosphere. But now I get stuff back that gives, really, I read it in the morning and I get the chills, and I'm really so happy also because I get to see that most of the students really ended up living productive and good lives, worthwhile lives, and so that's important to me too. Later on in the 90s, I created a school which was a real second, third, fourth chance school in the alternative superintendency, which served young people who were overaged, undercredited, and not really having a hard adolescence. I think that was the core. That was probably the similar thing for every one of them. And again, we weren't creating performers. We were trying to find a way to engage young people long enough so that they could begin to feel some personal success, so that then they would be willing to try things that were not in their comfort zone and try, so we would try to backdoor into their intelligence. The performing arts are an intellectual, intelligent pursuit. They are perhaps, I mean, we're talking maybe left brain, right brain, but clearly it's about intelligence. You don't see too many really stupid performers and entertainers and whatever. It requires a discipline, a tenacity, a courage. It requires content, information, communication skills. We use those modalities to help young people who have skills. They're not necessarily the testable skills that mainstream America wants from them, but they've survived in neighborhoods very often that many of the people in my family couldn't survive in, and have learned how to get by. I mean, if you look at somebody who's basically illiterate, they've been hiding that all of their lives. It takes more effort to hide it than actually to learn the skill of how to read. It's just that there becomes no place in this society to be able to deal with your inabilities, your limitations. So rather than actually own up to the things that you don't know how to do, you just try to cover them. And as you cover them, you end up with defense mechanisms that make you act out and do things that are not helpful to your to success.
And a lot of times they probably don't even know that they have these limitations.
Of course, they don't know that they have the limitations, but even more important, they don't know they have any strengths, because they really are very self-hating. Because the society, on all of the things that society judges them on, they basically fail. And so they don't have a good sense of themselves.
So you were saying that you need to see the details and the totality.
Yeah, I think to be an effective principal, certainly, you have to see all of the details, but you also have to see the totality. And that's not only for this year. You have to be able to project into the future and see your direction from your past out into what it is that you want your students to be able to do into the future. So that's... I think that's one of the characteristics of a good principal. I was always rather amazed when I would meet teachers who, when you ask them about themselves, they define themselves as the computer teacher or an English teacher. And it seemed to me that that was such an amazing limitation and such a limited way of projecting themselves. And when I was the director of arts for the alternative superintendency, I would go into schools and start doing staff development. And in doing staff development, the principals and staff would say, "We don't have money for the arts." And in a few minutes, I'd ask them who they were, what they did, what their passions were. And as they went around the circle, you'd see that this person who defined themselves as a computer teacher actually sang in the opera as one of their so-called hobbies. And another person wasn't an artist, but they were a carpenter. And another person was a gourmet chef, and one person adored jazz, and they had a collection that was second to none. And once they began to see each other in a different light, connections automatically happened within that circle, and it generated a lot of, "I tap dance, I like to sew, I like to paint, I like to do this," and right there you saw yourself putting together a production with the carpenter and the costume person and the tap dancer and whatever, and that they had resources, but the way the system defined them didn't in any way encourage or support them seeing themselves as more than a part of themselves. And I think that that's one of the secrets to being successful as the principal in a school, was to see the sum total of what students brought to the table. Some students weren't great readers, some students weren't great at math, some students were incredibly funny, and some students were incredibly nice and loyal and great leaders. And in an environment that celebrates everyone's strengths and not only putting them in a category, if you're not a good reader, you're not a good person. And that's what our country does a lot to young people. If you're not a good reader, you're not a good person. If you're not perfect at things, reading, math, all of that stuff, you can't live a decent life and you can't be an honorable person. And I reject that wholeheartedly. And I think we do an awful lot of damage to our young people because we don't honor them and we don't give them the tools to actually look at themselves and honor their strengths and give them enough confidence to look at their liabilities, their limitations, and take them on, because they're so defensive about everything because they don't feel good about anything. The work that I do now, which I absolutely adore doing, is going into whatever environment I'm invited to. For example, I do orientations at community colleges. I do a stint in a high school in between two semesters. Last week we did a 2-hour workshop with 5 different community colleges that are working together, national community colleges from all over the place that are working together under some grant that they got. And what we do is we use the performing arts as a tool to really touch different places in people and get them thinking and moving in different ways. That's not an answer that you can really understand, so I'll give you, I like to work for more than 2 hours, but that's all I had for this particular opportunity. We start out with this list poem, which we do, where everyone can put personal information on this list poem. And then we taught a song to them, and we add signing to the song. And then we sent them out with the 3 teaching artists into 3 different groups, and we just counted them off so that they were not going with their friends who they were sitting next to, for sure. And so you get to mix up the groups a little bit. And the task that they had in those groups was to create a performing piece with the information that they had gathered in their poem and bring it back to everyone for a performance. Really, the whole thing was 2 hours, so up to the last half hour, they returned back to the center. Each one of these groups performed. They sang the song that we all did together. They returned to their own college tables and created a cheer or an affirmation about something that they were going to do in the future. And we did those in a series, and the last one was a really comical one, so it was like the perfect punctuation. And then this entire group went off to lunch. And they went off to lunch different than they did when they gathered in the morning with their coffee and their bagels. They just were different. They had met people. They had shared things in a deep and personal way. One person described him, said there were 3 college presidents within this group, and they were the top echelon of their cabinets. These were people who had some hierarchical relationship with each other. And what this does is it breaks that completely and creates a different, it's a paradigm shift. It just creates a different way of people interacting with each other. So it's very fascinating. One of the questions they were asked was a defining moment. I mean, one person said that their defining moment was the death of their child. One person said it was the job they had at the college. I mean, there's such breadth to it, but you cannot not be moved by even hearing one personal thing about the people that you're working with. And it's very touching, it's very freeing, and at the end of it, there is a real sense of accomplishment and joy that everyone feels having gotten out of their comfort zone and trying something, doing something new together. So it's very successful, but it is in fact not, it's a different structure, but it's not all that different from what we did in the schools to make young people feel good about themselves there. And that was to give them experiences, throw things at them, have a high expectation for them, insist on a level of excellence from them, and use the performing arts to get a lot of the magic that happened in those schools.
So that's what you do now?
That's what I do now, yeah.
Can you briefly go over your whole career?
Yeah. I was placed in a school in East Harlem. I think my parents were a little bit horrified. I had gone to school in Boston. I could have stayed in Boston to go to school, but to start teaching. In those days, the public school system of New York actually sent recruits to Boston to recruit for the school system. But I chose to come back to New York. I had lived out on Long Island. I came to New York. I was placed in a school in East Harlem. I spent 9 years there until my incredible principal mentor suggested that I go speak to the superintendent of District 4, who was young and innovative and was open to ideas. And I went to him, as I said, and Debbie Meyer did within the same two-week period, and we were the first two startup schools in East Harlem in the 70s, in those halcyon days when everyone came to East Harlem to be part of that new school movement that we had there. It was a thrilling time, and that school I created was the East Harlem Performing Arts School, which is no longer functioning. It's no longer there, but I've grown to understand that things have their time, and as long as the young people were served who we had then all's good, and that nothing is for forever. The second school I created is still actually, it's a working school, but it has moved totally from the initial premise of the school. And our premise was to serve disenfranchised young people who were really not doing well and who felt badly about themselves, and use the performing arts as almost a trick tool to get them engaged in their own development again. These are young people who were in several schools before and were unsatisfactory. They had few family systems that kept them coming to school every day or not coming late. They had already built in some very, very poor habits, and it took every bit of our strength to break down those poor habits and try to get them to think differently about themselves and to do what they needed to do to move on and be successful. And since I've been out of the school system, of course, they've dismantled alternative schools, and this particular administration has created a morale in schools which is just, it's almost like a flat line. People feel so bad in schools. I've just heard horrible things about what's going on. You know, you can't use a corporate model. You're talking about serving human beings. You're talking about teachers who are human beings. You're giving them tasks that are monumental. If they're going to really do their job well, not only do they have to be Renaissance people who can do 9 things right. I mean, one of my favorite stories is about probably one of the best teachers I ever met, and he shall remain nameless because I'm going to say something that would probably shed bad light on me and him. But he came to me. He came out of a bank, so I knew he could do economics. Mm-hmm. He had run a gospel chorus, so I knew he could do that. I asked him if he showed some interest in signing, so we decided to use signing as a second language because it's so dramatic and artistic, and it changes the playing field, and it's not that the Hispanic kids would have a leg up or whatever. We thought that would be a great thing as well. So I'm asking this young man to do all of these things. He's probably one of the most gifted teachers I have ever met in my entire life of doing this work over the last 50 years or something. He's incredible, but he really, really had a lateness problem. And for me, if I had really seriously written him up on mm-hmm. his lateness problem, mm-hmm. he would have not made it to the second year. And he's worked on this problem. I can't say it's perfect. He's worked on it, and he's really some, you know, this is some 20-some-odd years later. But he is such a gifted teacher that he filled up, and when I think of him, I feel it. He filled up the hearts and minds and whatever, and is still doing that to this day. Anyone he touches with a magic that they will go through the rest of their lives and never forget it. So did I break the rules, and did I do something I probably, the school system says I shouldn't have, but I knew that what he offered kids was so much more valid and important. He was magical, and that was more important. And I would try to figure out ways where he could come later and stay later. And we tried to figure out ways and set up systems to try to help him deal with his limitation and liability without throwing out the baby with the bathwater. And I'm afraid that we do that too often in this culture. We don't build on the strengths of what people have, including children and teachers, instead of expecting them to be able to do everything. And when you are running a small school like that, you're really looking for everybody to kick in a lot of different skills to make it happen, because you need to put on Band-Aids and be the therapist and the counselor and deal with sexual issues with teenagers. I mean, they're with parent issues with parents, issues with student to student issues. I mean, complicated things beside the content of one of the courses that you're teaching. I think the key to my success actually is that I have created this balance between creating something that impacts on everyone together, which I call company, when we are all together and we're learning things and doing things with one voice, whether it's singing a song or having a guest lecturer come in or a panel or a performance. We're all doing it together. We're all experiencing it together. That balanced with the individual's journey in their classes to learn specific things that are important for their knowledge base. So it's this balance between all of us being this company, being all together. And I think that not only do teenagers need to believe that they belong to something, I find that having done that workshop just a week ago with the older educators, and I've done it with superintendents and principals and teachers and parents, I've done the same work, and everyone comes to the table with a notion of self-doubt. Am I going to be able to do this? Oh my God, are they going to make us stand up? Oh my God, am I going to look stupid? Am I going to be able to do this? And at the end of it, if you say create a safe space and your people know what they're doing in order to guide people through the activities, and all of mine do, they end up with this sense of exhilaration about, oh wow, I didn't even know I could do that. I didn't know I could do that. And as a matter of fact, I like doing it. As a matter of fact, I'd like to continue doing that. There's so much discovery. I've done this work where an ESL child, a youngster, coming from China, came over to me and said to me, I did not know I could sing and dance and act. I did not know I could do that. She came into the workshop experience not knowing that she could even follow the instructions in English. And at the end of a few days, she not only made friends, not only improved her English, but she did it singing songs and dancing and acting out with people, and she walked away with so much more confidence than she ever could have if somebody threw her in an English class. So I never think that this is revelatory. I always think this is really sort of common sense, and I just am baffled. I am baffled because I've been Sisyphus a lot of my life inside of this system, you know, pushing that rock up the hill and knocks you down. You push it up. When you asked me to interview me, I'm thinking to myself, I've been out of the school system, as I've been retired from the school system for 9 years. There has never been a person inside the school system who ever asked me anything about anything, even though I may be one of a handful, if not the only person, who created and ran two small schools inside this school system. I have never once been asked anything about the practice, what I was thinking, how did we do it, what were the outcomes, why did we do certain things. So you're asking me these questions are important to me, to put it out into the ether and let those people who are struggling with these issues understand that I support them and I applaud them for making schools wonderful places for young people. There are those who, like me, who use the performing arts. There are those who use all kinds of different things. But the elements need to be there to make it a place that accept and make people feel good about themselves. I happen to think that the performing arts are communication skills, and then that communication skills are life skills, and that they, no matter whether anyone ever does anything in life but go through life, that they need all of these skills anyway. You need to be able to present your ideas and talk to people and look people in the eye and walk in this world where your body, you have the kind of courage and strength to feel confident enough about yourself. Bank Street had a project which was not funded this year, and hopefully it will be funded again. It was affected by the financial decline. But for a few summers, we would have a group of students who actually the majority of them came out of the parochial schools, and they were pretty good students academically. And then there was another group of students who came out of the public schools who were not very successful. And they brought me in to try to make one group out of these two different groups and to change the playing field by putting them all in performing arts activities, not just in more traditional academic activities where their strengths and weaknesses would play out just automatically the way one would anticipate. So for a few summers, we would take this group of students who would have a sleepover, a residential experience at a local college. And so they would be there for Monday through Friday for 3 weeks, which was an amazing way to impact on young people. And so the part that we delivered, my group delivered, was about 3 hours in the middle of the day where we came in and did our arts immersion, where again, we start with company, they go out into the studio classes, they take two different classes, they come back for company, because we always begin and end everything together as an ensemble, building our strength as a total group, so that the messages that you're giving is everyone does this. Everyone does this, and this is the way we behave, and this is how we respect each other, and this is the way we show what we're doing and share things, and this is the way everyone gets to know everyone who's involved in the project. All of the young people get to know everyone, not just the ones in their classes, and all of the staff get to be seen, and the staff actually share some of their artistry. So this day someone will do a song that they've just written, and another day someone will do a monologue that they have as part of their gig, or there'll be a stand-up funny piece that someone who is an improv person does, because the people who deliver these classes in the performing arts are multifaceted people who not only are great teachers and love teaching, but they are very, very talented in their own right. And so they really are Renaissance people. And what I love about it, what I love about doing this work, is I love being with them, because their creativity and their energy and their goodness, I fly home at the end of one of these very exhausting gigs that we do together. But it is so exhilarating to be around people who are positive and are believers and can see the good in things, in a world where so much of the reverse of that is the everyday headline. It is just exhilarating. It creates more energy to be around people who create energy. Your brain starts getting creative, and you start thinking of a song that you should write for this group, or this that, I mean, it just goes off. It's like a flow chart that goes out into the universe, and it's very exciting. So
and what's the name of this?
Well, my umbrella is called Echo Arts. It's EKO Arts, but it's an echo, and an echo that reverberates around and among the people who participate in it, that it after the workshop is over, that it still has a life of its own. Is it resonates in the hearts of the people who participated. And I don't ever want to sound arrogant, but without sounding like there's too much hubris involved, I do hear from enough people on Facebook and in life who really value the work that we did with them. And that includes teachers, because, as I say, teachers are spoken to in a way that fragments them from their own total being and only uses one part of who they are. And what this tries to do is bring the humanity out in everyone, no matter if you're a young person or a teacher, an administrator. And I'd love to actually in some day break into a corporate structure. I'd like to deal with returning vets. I'd love to deal with ex-offenders, so people who were incarcerated. I'd love to deal with all aspects. I'd love to deal with my age group, the older people of this world, because I think what this does, it's like that Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney thing, you know, there's an empty barn, let's put on a production. There is nothing more exhilarating than working with a bunch of people, everyone having their tasks to do, and it comes together, and the collective work of everyone is so much greater than any one person could do, that it makes you feel connected to people, and it makes you feel good, and it makes you begin to see yourself in a more positive way. And you're willing then to take more risks and chances to begin to do those things that you don't do as well. It gives you confidence to do the things that you don't do as well. And I think that's where the school system really, really misses the boat, by not creating more than one track for, you have to be great in reading, you have to be great in math, you have to be great in reading, you have to be great in math. And if you're not great in those two things, you're not even worthwhile as a person. And that really is not an acceptable premise.
You're telling me about the kind of students that you had at your East Harlem school.
The East Harlem Performing Arts School, that was an upper elementary and a junior high school. And those were kids who came out of the local feeder schools. Anyone whose parent was willing to send them across East Harlem to come to this new location. But my second school was a school that served students who were really definitely not successful in their first, second, or third times that they were in high schools. I had a couple of experiences that really taught me something. We always worked in something called Institute, where the same theme, everyone in the school was working with the same theme, and we would always be together in this large group activity that I've described before as company. And one time I had the head of the Vera Institute of Justice come in to speak to them. And he came in and he brought an associate of his. And one of the questions that they asked all of my students, who I thought I knew very, very, very well, about 170 of them, how many of you have been stopped by the police? Now, this was in the 90s. It was way, way, way earlier than stop and frisk, and there was no language put on this kind of phenomenon. And every single hand of every single student went up to say that they were harassed or stopped on their way to and from school or in their communities or whatever by the police, and that there was a real feeling of harassment from the police community. Now, I grew up in the suburbs of New York, out on Long Island, and when I grew up, I thought that the cops were our friends, and I had every stereotypical notion until I was sitting in a car waiting for a boyfriend of mine to come out of a music rehearsal on 125th Street, and two cop cars surrounded me because they wanted to know what was a nice white girl like you doing up here. You must have been looking for drugs or something. And that sort of started me on my own personal journey on how things are not exactly as they appear to be. And so when I fast forward to when we were on 43rd Street above Town Hall, which is still the current site of Public School Repertory Company, although it is in a totally different form, it's now more of a boutique small performing arts school, and it didn't serve the population that I was dedicated to serving. But, you know, when our kids would walk down the street, it's like people were always nervous because they looked like urban youth walking down the street on 43rd Street in large numbers. And, you know, that kind of legacy where, I mean, teenagers have a hard time in our culture anyway, but if you're urban teenagers, and I know it's a two-way street. We worked very hard at them understanding perceptions on both sides and how to behave outside and how not to be too loud and not to be in such large groups and not to take over the sidewalk and stuff like that. Because for me, educating them inside the school, outside of the school, how much tip to leave at a restaurant, how do you take a cab, how do you do this, how do you negotiate the city, I felt like all of that was my responsibility because I wanted them to be able to function in whatever part of the society they wanted to function in. I wasn't guiding them into mainstream. They could choose to. I had a deep respect for the creativity and of their own lives, but I just felt like if I didn't do it, who's going to do it? In some cases, they just did not have systems in place that would provide them with a kind of learning that I wanted them to have. We took them to the theater. They had to know that each seat is an assigned seat. They had to know that you can't comment out loud on what you're seeing. You have to process that information. It's critical thinking. That as much time is spent on developing those audience skills as it is looking at the content of what was in the play and what the issues were and the conflicts were to prepare young people for a rich life. And no matter where they were born and no matter what their access to money is, that was our goal, to try to even even the playing field and give opportunity to young people. And my most recent story is that I got an online hit from someone saying, is this the right Ellen? And it was a student who was one of the 10 first students to create the public school repertory company, which started out as a summer program. And we found out that we were going to have a school, and we had 2 weeks to set up a school from that summer program to the fall. And it was a small school. It was before charters. And we did it. And I did it with a person as my assistant who had been in my third, fourth grade class. I was her art teacher. Fifth, sixth grade class in the special class that preceded our creating a school in East Harlem. She went to that school. Her brothers went to that school. And then she went on to Music and Art High School, Syracuse University, and whatever. And as she was graduating from Syracuse, I said to her, Cindy, will you come back and work with me to create this new school? And she said yes, and now she's a highly successful principal of a very large junior high school in Queens. So anyway, Larry reaches out to me, and he just wanted to connect. And I love it, too. He just wanted to connect, and I wanted to know, how is he in life, and what is he doing? Well, he's a carpenter, and he loves making wooden boxes, but he sings on the weekend. He said he did weddings and bar mitzvahs and whatever, which I thought was really cute. I remembered about him that he had some real issues as a teenager. He was a mixed kid. He was black and white, absentee father, and now he's a father. And there was something special. He said to me, which just gave me goosebumps, he said, when I was in your school, it was the first time I ever understood freedom. Now, that was amazing. That was just amazing. I could see that this young man had the goods, and I could see that he didn't know he had the goods. And it was my job to get him to see that he had the goods. But for me to hear some 20 years later or whatever, 25 years later, that he is a functioning, alive, working, loving father, a husband, that he gets satisfaction out of his work, that he gets satisfaction out of his creative outlets. Nothing in the entire world, except for maybe this new little grandbaby that was just born in my family, can ever make me feel as rich and as fulfilled. That's the purpose and the meaning of my life, and I'm just thrilled, and I'm grateful to him that he reached out to me and that we could keep a dialogue going. And I don't know how many teachers back in the day ever got to hear from their students, but because of the internet, which I'm certainly not very good at, students have been finding me, and they have a real need to say thank you for the kind of environment that we created that honored them. Back in the day, 1965 was my first teaching assignment at PS 108. I was the special ed teacher. Back in those days, there was a dress code for women. Women could not wear pants. Women wore suits and dresses. And a few years after that, when the dress code actually was challenged by the union, I believe, and women could wear almost anything, my principal, my lovely, lovely, amazing principal, Ralphine Gross, still wore these elegant European suits every day. And she would come into this school in East Harlem, and she'd walk to each door, and she'd speak to the children in a different language and welcome them every day. And when we'd have assembly, which we had a lot, she would open the back doors, and as she would proceed into the auditorium, every little hand would go up with a peace
symbol. You're listening to the real,
which meant get quiet. And she would never, ever raise her voice or do whatever. She'd get in front of the kids. She'd talk to them in different languages. And so the day would begin. And it was in her presence and with some of the things that she did that I began to use the auditorium as the place where we could really build community. build community. That is one of the tenets of my work. That's one of the most important things of my work. We call it company, but building community is really a key, because when you're part of a community, the shared parts of a community just feel good. If someone came and did a performance for us, whether it was Cool in the Gang or Pete Seeger or other people who came to our little school in East Harlem, every student would stand up and sing from Stephen Schwartz's, I don't remember if it was Pippin or Godspell, I think Pippin, All Good Gifts, and we would, it's a thank you song, and we would thank them back for their sharing and coming up to see us. It was always like a ball that would roll, you know, just gathering moss, because then the artists would be so impressed with the kids, and it would create a kind of synergy that was so exciting, and everyone walked away feeling so great. Even I remember the case of Pete Seeger, because the adult staff was so excited that Pete Seeger was coming to East Harlem to our school. But the kids didn't know who Pete Seeger was. And even, you know, even 20 years ago, he looked like an older man to them. But it was much more than 20 years ago. Holy mackerel, it's like 40 years ago. But not only our excitement, but our explaining what he had done and how courageous he had been and what he stood for and how he used song as a tool to creating community and doing things that are good for people through singing. And now when I walk into a school, I think about that dress code that I was referring to a while back. So when the dress code was lifted, people started to get really comfortable to the point of being sloppy in schools. And in many cases, there was very little professional considerations about how people dressed. And I remember I had like this music club after school, and I did this stuff, and I would wear this cap. And I know that wearing that cap was something that my principal couldn't stand that I was doing. But I actually felt more affinity to the students as a brand new teacher than I did to some of the adult teachers in the school. They were sort of sucking their teeth at the way I was being with students. And I never wanted students to be my friend, but I guess I was more casual than they were in their strict way of being with students. And I actually didn't have all that much age difference from the students as I had when I started out from then I did with the adults around. But what I loved about my principal is that she was able to see where my gifts were without necessarily loving all the things that I did. She hated that I wore that stupid hat and actually commented on it. And I was dumb enough in my own maturation or lack thereof to not snatch it off my head and stop wearing it immediately, because I still wanted to express my individuality. But now when I walk into schools as a much, much older woman and I see sometimes what teachers are wearing, I'm really offended. I'm really offended by some of the outfits. How do you say, I believe in myself, I believe in the work that we're doing, and I believe in you, and wear something that looks like you plowed a field with it and then just slipped into it the next day? You know, I don't think that's a professional way of representing.
What is the basic uniform of a teacher, would you say, like today? Or should it be?
I think it can be professional.
Jeans?
It could be, you know, at the beginning of the uniform movement, I was totally and completely against it. I would not let my kids do caps and gowns because I wanted each individual student to look like an individual. And over time, I've modified my view a little bit, because really, I've gone into a few schools where there's not only a dress code for the students, but there is one for the adults. And it just makes the environment look like something's going on. I'm not sure how I feel about it. I think some of those uniforms are just too rigid, and they just don't allow for the kind of creative dirtiness that comes from
being involved in activities like the arts. I think they're a little confining. However, I do think that the opposite of not having a dress code, and it started to get very tricky with kids. I mean, with the boys wearing their pants below their tuchuses and the, you know, the hats and the some inappropriate tops on young women and whatever. There have to be standards for dress for every population in the schools. But whether or not they have to look totally the same is still debatable for me. I think that there are probably pluses and minuses in both camps. One of the words that I always used a lot was appropriate. I wanted appropriate behavior. I wanted appropriate action. And I was speaking to Cindy, my former student, through all of those things, who then became my assistant director of the school and is now running her own junior high school. She said that the word that everyone equates with her is analogies, because she always uses analogies, which we did back in the day, building those skills into everyday life and using comparisons in life. So they equate Cindy with analogies, and they used to equate me with appropriate. So those words have sort of a resonance with us.
I get appropriate. I'm not sure.
The analogies. Well, I think what she was saying, we were exploring what things in her mind worked in the classroom and in the schools that she's taken on to her school, which things resonated with her. And we used to do analogies all the time. We used to build test-taking skills, and using those test-taking skills in everyday use in the classroom so that everybody was much more familiar with them. And they weren't just done on the test, but we would play with those things. And so we'd play with analogies, and we'd play with the other forms that they would have on the test. We sort of dissect it and make that part of our day. And so I guess she's brought that over to her school.
Okay. I want to ask you about the school that you're opening now, which is a charter school, and your feeling about charter schools.
Charters are the only game in town. Politically, I feel like it is the destruction of public education, which I spent my entire life working for. And we were able to create those two small schools. And I do not believe that by creating charters, you couldn't have created, supported small schools instead. But a friend of mine is creating a charter school. I believe in my friend, and I believe in his organization. And so I've been helping them, taking some of that framework and some of those things that I consider, some of those rituals and some of those practices and some of the ways that I believe that both the East Harlem Performing Arts School and Public School Repertory Company were successful. The summer projects, the summer seminar, and what I do now, they all have certain threads in them, and the threads are about building a community of people who feel good about themselves, who are respected. And so I've been working with a group of people who are trying to build a charter school. And again, I'm torn about not creating a school that will serve a group of young people who would not otherwise be served. I'm very clear about that, and that's why I'm doing it. But I'm not really at all happy with charter schools. I think that it's just destruction of... I equate public schools and democracy. I think that it was the opportunity to come into New York and go to public schools that actually created American democracy. And as people moved forward to the West Coast and got more and more detached in a way, and what went on in those public schools. So the first generation went to public schools, and maybe the second generation went to suburban schools, and maybe the third generation went on to prep schools. And before you knew it, you had generations of people who had no connection or no investment at all in public education. And the more that the public schools became schools of people of color, and the less services, the fewer orchestras, the fewer arts programs, the fewer sports programs went into them, it's part of the legacy of a racist America, I believe, where as the color of the students changed, so too changed the funding. And so I've moved now from why I always felt that the public school system was so important. I do believe that the public school system was allowed to begin to disintegrate and fail. Although there are stellar, stellar public schools to this very day inside the system, but there are failing schools inside the system. But I don't believe that the way to do that is to close down schools, put charters inside, and take away unions and take away people's opportunity for career security, employment, whatever. There's something unsavory about the whole picture of charters to me, even though I do understand that they are where it's at now. And so I made a decision to help create a charter school. And I'm not 100% comfortable with it, but I rather have it be a good school, even though it's a charter, than not be part of trying to add those things to it that I think are so important that are lacking in so many public schools.
How do you recreate what you've done with your peers and your colleagues? Don't you need to really have certain sensitivities in order to make your system work, if it is what you would call a system?
I have no idea how to make it work now. This last administration has their own notion of what makes for schools. They built a corporate model. They put everybody in little cubbies in the same room. They hired tons of young consultants who have never taught a day in their lives and have no sense of history of the school system. They got rid of pretty much anyone who had any history. I have never been contacted. I don't know of anybody who's ever been contacted about what we did in the school system. They've created these businesses. You know, this is Tuesday, everyone is doing this. They've made everything, or tried to make everything, the same. I'm very disheartened at what's happened to the school system. Having been part of those halcyon days in District 4 in the 70s, it was a thrill. It was thrilling to be part of what we were doing. We worked incredibly hard. We worked around the clock. But we were so dedicated, and it wasn't just me and my school. There were tons of new schools that were created then. We felt like we were changing the world. We felt like we were changing the world. We were certainly the first ones changing the school system. We knew how to do it. We knew what needed to be done. And so many years later that they turn away from the school system, even though there are some of us who feel like we knew how to do it. In some cases, we did it in spite of the school system, because the school system never made it easy to create small schools. And I think what happened was that by doing charter schools, you don't have to follow any constraints of the system or the unions. It opened it up, I guess, to other interpretations. But I think we're going to lose something significant as well as gain something in turning our backs on public education. I think it's a terribly destructive, almost shameful thing for this government to do, is to turn its back on public education instead of making it a stellar educational model, and not the same everywhere. I mean, when Arizona gets rid of ethnic studies and this one gets, I mean, the notion of making this all white bread pablum that doesn't reflect the needs and the ancestors of each neighborhood that we're in, I think would be a terrible way to go. So that's my take.
Thank you, Nick, and thank you, Ellen. This has been Teacher Talk here on killradio.org. We're live every Sunday at noon, and if you are a teacher or you know a teacher who could participate and has something to say about LA Unified or any school system, please give us a call when we're live at 213-252-0998. This is DJ Bennett for Teacher Talk. Thanks for listening.